Hey everybody, and welcome back. It's season two of the Brew University Book Club. Yes, we made it all the way through season one, and now we are on to season two, brand new book, and a mostly brand new panel of people to talk about it. So we can't wait to have you join us and dive in. This season, we will be talking about The Ideal Team Player by Pat Lencioni, a really fantastic book that I am excited to share with you. And joining me to talk about it is my panel of book club readers, new panel, new season, and I can't wait to introduce them to you, beginning in Tampa with our CNG sales director, Joe Walczak. Joe, how you doing?
Doing great, Jeff. Happy to be here.
Also joining us from Minnesota, Andrew Ferber, our off-premise sales manager. Hi, Andrew. How's it going?
Great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to have you here. Nate Eisenhower is our Tampa delivery manager, and he's here with us as well. Hi, Nate.
Hey, how are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fantastic. Glad to have you on board. And I brought a few HR people along because it's always a good thing to have when we're talking about teams and people, and that's what this book is all about. Beginning with Kara Trebency, our HR director in Minnesota. Hi, Kara.
Good morning, Jeff. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing this morning?
Good.
Glad to have you with us. And of course, also with us, our one returning player from season one. She was so great, I had to bring her back a second time. Suzanne Borges is with us, our HR director in Tampa. Hi, Suzanne.
I'm back.
Yes, she is. All right. So this is our crew for season two, and we are excited to be reading our way through The Ideal Team Player by Pat Lencioni. So I wanted to get started with this one. We're going to talk about this book, and like many of Pat's books, this is sort of built into two parts. There's the fable at the front where he sort of gives us this story version of what he's trying to get across. And then in the second half of the book, he really dives in more to the technical side of the model that he's built and the ideas that he wants to convey. But before we get into any of it, I wanted to take a minute and sort of talk a little bit about this book and where it belongs in his pantheon and how it fits into what we're doing here at J.J. Taylor, because this book is really sort of the second half of a book that is near and dear to all of our hearts, which is The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. You know, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team came out in 2002 and was a very, very fundamental book for many companies, including our own, in terms of how teams and people work with each other, interact with each other, and ultimately are able to build a team that can function and perform at high levels. But when that book came out, it missed sort of half the mark. And I remember reading this book when it first came out and feeling like, okay, this is really good stuff, and I'm really learning a lot about how a team interacts. But what seemed missing to it was always the idea of, well, what kind of people do you need in order for that to work? And he touches on it a little bit in Five Dysfunctions and shows that a couple of the team players cannot actually play and ultimately have to leave the team in that book. But he never does what he does for team dynamics, which is give us a real tangible language-based model of what is it that makes somebody capable of being part of that Five Dysfunctions model in the first place. And so it took him 14 years, but he finally got around to it, and he wrote The Ideal Team Player, and that's what this book is really all about. This book is sort of the prequel, if you will, to Five Dysfunctions, in that before you can have a team of functioning people, you have to have individuals who are capable of functioning on that team, and The Ideal Player lays down that model. So I'm just curious, before we, again, dive into the depths of this particular book, let me ask my panel, how did you guys feel sort of in general, opening thoughts, opening statements on this book, and where it fits sort of in concert with the Five Dysfunctions and things like that? What were some big takeaways that you guys noticed coming into this one? And had you read it before?
Well, I have never read the book before, Jeff. And I can tell you this, it's such a simple book to read. And there was a central theme that I kept picking up on, and that is everything in it was almost too simple. It makes you think about it. And yet I couldn't stop thinking about it in regards to my own team, reading through it and trying to grasp onto the concepts. My mind just went back to every time I hire somebody, and man, I don't think I'll ever look at it the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is one of the hallmarks of a good Lencioni book, is he gives us a model and an idea and a set of language that we can apply to how we interact with others in some area. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. You can't kind of go back to the old world. And this is definitely one of those. Other big thoughts kind of coming into The Ideal Team Player that you guys found. What'd you think about the book and sort of that big perspective?
I just think his three virtues of hungry, humble, smart, they really ring true. And I've always said at J.J. Taylor, before I read the book, You have to be liked here. You have to do your job and you have to show up every day. Those are really the three things. And in reading the book, I see how those virtues relate to each of the things that the theory that I had created for our J.J. Taylor leadership and culture.
It's true. Suzanne and I had talked about this before this book even came out. This was a longstanding observation that Suzanne has had, and it's part of why I wanted to make sure she was on this one with us, is you do. There's sort of that trifecta of what does it take to be a successful person in certain companies, and ours included. Of, you know, again, just show up, be likable, do your work, right? And this, in the same way, he puts different language to it, but he's saying the same thing, is there are some fundamentals that you've got to get right if you even want to be accepted into a functioning and performing team. And without that, you just don't even have a chance. And when you start to falter in any of those categories, which we'll dive into as we talk about the book, you can see quickly how people can end up being, you know, out on the outside of the team real quick because they fail in one, even in one of these three. But certainly once you cross that 2 out of 3 missing, you start to really quickly go, yeah, this is not someone that can be a part of our group anymore. Any other big thoughts to get us started? Did you like it? Had anybody read this before coming in?
I've never read it, but I thought it was really relatable to just experiences that I've had in delivery here in Tampa, just from past managers and just going through a lot of transitioning. You really see the difference, like if this was implicated a long time ago, how much better things could have been, like from the start.
Yeah, it almost pains me sometimes to realize that it took him 14 years after the first book to write this book, because I really do think that this actually is the prequel to Five Dysfunctions. You have to know this, because Five Dysfunctions is great, and we love that model, and we love what it tells us about how people can work together as a team, but this fills in the missing piece of what type of people do I need to even have a chance at succeeding in that model, and without ideal team players, you have no chance of that team being functional in the first place, because anybody who fails on these metrics is never going to be able to meet the 5 steps in the, you know, and overcome those kinds of dysfunction. Anything else, big picture?
I would say I agree with Joe's theory on the simplicity of the model. I think it's a simple read. It's brilliant in how easy it is to understand the concepts and apply them. And I also think it's important to like take a look at yourself and like put the model back towards you and look at maybe some areas that you need to improve on. Maybe your attitude isn't great all the time, or maybe you need to show more hunger, you know, in the day-to-day operations of what we do. So I thought it was kind of introspective in a way, just to like look at areas that I need to work on. You can apply it obviously to your direct reports, people underneath you, but also to your peers and people above you. So it's just a really good, simple way to, I think, assess how you're doing, your performance, and then how your team and your the peers that you work with. So I really enjoyed it.
Andrew, I love that you brought that up, because I couldn't agree with you more. This is probably one of the books that I've read in the last 2 or 3 years that most had me looking at myself going, okay, how do I rank on this? How am I measuring up when it comes to these three things? And what can I do to improve in the ones that I'm, you know, shallow in, or you know, am I, you know, where can I stack rank myself? This book is a really, really good gut check for most people to say, am I being an ideal team player? And I think as leaders, it's also a really great metric to be able to look at your team and go, when I see someone struggling, when I have a team member who isn't getting it done, when I have somebody who isn't able to be successful, which one of these three are they failing on? Or which ones of these three are they failing on that maybe I can target it and help with their development or their performance to get them back above the line. So, yeah, I think it's interesting, and we'll talk about this here in a moment as we get into it. This is probably one of the slowest burns of any book he's got. It takes a long time for him to really ramp up to what he's talking about here. In fact, as we'll see, the characters take a while to sort of figure out how to say what they're trying to say. But once you see it, you can't unsee it. And it really is a great model to be used.
I was just going to say as well, you know, how relatable the scenarios are, especially from a recruiting standpoint, the how they were able to, you know, identify and profile the who they wanted in this position and the networking that they attempted to do. but then identifying, let's look inside, you know, let's not go outside the organization. Let's look inside. Let's see who is, as they say, not a jackass. So I just feel like this was very relatable from the recruitment standpoint as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Karen. I think that's what the heart of this book is really about. It's selection, it's talent selection, whether it's internal, external. This tells us this is that brilliant model of how do we make sure we're getting the right people. And getting the right people just could not be more important. I mean, when it comes to recruitment and when it comes to staffing, I always like to think that, you know, it's staffing is a lot like real estate. You make all your money on the buy, right? You know, you buy a house, you want it as turnkey as possible, and then you can improve on that. You can fix a lot. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot to be done. But the better you get at the buy, the better off you're going to be in the long haul. And staffing's no different. We can do a lot with training and development, but training and development is best applied to someone who's already got a good foundation and a good solid core of ethics and work habits and things to build on. And so with this model, I think it gives us such a beautiful metric and rubrics to be able to say, who are we looking for? How do we make sure that when we hire somebody, they've got these at least three core things? Because training and development can take that a long way and make big improvements. But if we have to take training and development time and effort back into fixing any one of these three core things, it's going to be so much more difficult, right? It's the difference between, put in new carpets and a new coat of paint and maybe some shingles on the roof and this place is great, versus, no, I'm going to have to take this down to the foundation and fix the plumbing and root out the drywall. If you get those things right at the beginning, you're going to be much better positioned long term. And similarly with team members, if you get these three things that the book will talk about right, it's going to be so much easier to make somebody a superstar than if you have to go back and fix these things fundamentally. So, all right. Well, I think that does a good job of summarizing where this book sits in the world. So let's dive into it. The first half of this book is on the situation. We're going to talk about the first few chapters here today. Some of these chapters are lickety-split. He goes through some of these in a matter of pages. Some of them will take a little bit more. But this is, as I mentioned, a couple of things that I want to point out. One is we have a sequel. And I call it a prequel because the ideas really should come before the five dysfunctions. But we actually, as a book, we have a literal sequel here. Our main character is from the five dysfunctions, and that's given to us very early on when he talks about having worked for his previous boss, Catherine, who, of course, is the main character in Five Dysfunctions. And so our main character, our CEO of business development, former CEO of business development, Jeff from Five Dysfunctions, is now going to be our main protagonist as we go through here in The Ideal Team Player. So let's dive into the situation a little bit and talk about that transition. He starts by sort of setting up the situation that they're in. So why don't you guys give me your thoughts about the situation? I know it's a handful of pages, but I think there's some important stuff that he brings up in those pages. So,
well, I think it's an interesting time for us too. I mean, the situation is a nephew taking over a company, basically. And as we read these books, and, you know, we've all been through Jeff's training, and you'll see how it definitely applies to our company. I mean, we work for a small business, in air quotes, but, you know, a family-owned business. And I think right now too, we're seeing a transition. So with Zach coming on board. So when I started reading this, that just kind of rang true for me.
Yeah, a family business that's in the midst of a generational transition to someone whose previous experience is in the tech sector and not in the sector that they're moving into. Gosh, it's kind of relevant, I suppose, in that sense, isn't it? Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great point, Suzanne. There's a lot of real-time application for us in seeing where we're at as a company and where this book was coming from. So one of the things he does in this situation setup that I think is poignant is he takes us in a transition from, again, that world of tech, which is where Five Dysfunctions, and if you've read a lot of other Pat Lencioni books, you'll know that, you know, he himself is based out of San Francisco. He does a lot of work with his companies in Silicon Valley, and so he's done a lot of these books in the past about these tech and sort of startup type companies. And with this book, he made it a very big and intentional point, I think, to transition us out of the white-collar tech startup sort of world and into a traditional manufacturing and construction company. And I think there's sort of a point to be made there about this stuff doesn't just apply to people who are, you know, probably college educated and working in an office environment, that the five dysfunctions and the ideal team player and these concepts work no matter what industry that you're in. So I think he does a nice job of intentionally transitioning us. And, you know, it puts our main character in a bit of an unfamiliar situation and unfamiliar territory as well. But I like that he makes that transition and gives us an environment that I think for us probably feels more like home. What do you guys think?
I think the fact that he took it out of the tech world and jumped it into, you know, everyday work applies to J.J. Taylor. We've people from every background. We pull from everywhere. We've got people with criminal justice degrees. We've got people straight out of high school that jump in the beer business as merchandisers and roll the way the whole way through. I just think it's smart for him to say everyone from every background, this is such a simple model that can be applied to every person. And it's really that, just getting the right people. You can almost teach the business, and in the beer business, we can teach you how to deal with beer, but you've got to have the basic attributes of what we're looking for to make it even work. You know, you can't just train anybody. You can train everyone on the technical side, but if you don't have the groundwork, it's not going to work.
I think you're exactly right, Joe. He's making a pretty careful and intentional point to show that this isn't about the technical aspects of the job. It's about the culture, right? And the transition for our main character here is he's got to now fit a different culture than he's used to out of the startup world and into this more family style business. But as we'll see, as they go into, you know, finding other people to work with them, again, it all comes down to culture. And that's such a huge part of who we are as a company as well.
Well, just going back to, you know, the new CEO, Jeff, and how he is transitioning into this new culture and what he does, I feel is incredibly important. You know, going out to the different job sites, getting to know the people out at the job sites, getting to know his two new executives as well, Bobby and Claire, and getting their perspective of what the culture is like. They talk about, you know, they used to have four project managers, two of them are currently toxic, and then the other two left, you know, and then him being inquisitive as to why these two good project managers departed and why are we retaining these toxic ones. So I just feel like the way that he is approaching his way of learning the culture is, you know, he's taking those proper steps of learning that culture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the things that Lencioni does so well when he writes stories like this is, especially in the first half, he's not giving us the language yet. He's not giving us the model yet, but he's giving it to us through the characters. And we see it in Jeff as a CEO. He demonstrates humble and smart early on. Particularly humble, in as Kara's saying, you know, he takes the time to get out there. He spends time side by side. He works with the people. He gets to know them, gets to know who they are, isn't coming into it with a, oh, look at my background, look at my abilities. I've run companies 10 times this size. I've, you know, done all these things in a much more sophisticated industry than what you do. No, he comes into it with a complete humility and says, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm out of my element. I'm out of my league. Let me get into it hands on. And I think that is, again, showing us by example, laying the groundwork for how important these attributes are and why someone with them will become an ideal team player. They don't, you know, the characters at this point don't even yet realize it about themselves, but it's there. And that's a great example of demonstrating humbleness at the beginning. And it shows the value that that has for someone coming into the business. Because as Joe's saying, we bring people into this business all the time who have no idea what they're doing in this business. And I know that because I was one of them. You know, I knew training and development, but I had no beer experience coming into this. The key is when you have someone that's humble, they're going to absorb themselves in the business and they're going to learn what they need to learn because they've got the humility to say, I know that I don't know this and I'm willing to absorb it and get it. Great points both. So what else in the situation and sort of the setup? Where do we find ourselves in this character and what are some of the things you see Lencioni laying down early on in the book like this?
I like the fact that he came into and wanted to continue on with his uncle's image. He saw value in the way that his uncle ran his business. And obviously, you hear that throughout the book that Bob had a very strict image about what he wanted to be and what his company wanted to be. And, you know, it's similar to us. We have a vision. We have a first choice vision. And it starts with bringing people on. It starts that first interview, that first time you meet them. You can tell if somebody's gonna line up if you ask the right questions. And I just like the fact that, you know, you can have all the knowledge in the world, but you've got to also be cognizant of where you're entering and make sure it's a good fit for you and make sure it's a good fit for the company.
Absolutely. And another good example of that humbleness that our main character portrays, in that, you know, he doesn't come in with an intent to change. He comes in with an intent to integrate and say, okay, this place has been successful. It's very good at what it does. Yes, I've got ideas. Yes, I know things that I could maybe bring to the table and offer a change and whatnot, but I'm going to first pace before I try to lead. And I think there's a really strong lesson in that for a lot of young leaders, because we see, you know, a lot of managers, first-time managers, they get promoted up and their initial ideas, I'm going to do everything that I always thought should be done when I was not the manager, right? I'm going to do everything that my manager never did that I always suggested and they never said yes to. I've got my list of all the stuff that I've always said, if I ever get to be in charge, I'm going to do all of this. And it's really tempting. It's really tempting to jump in as a new leader and want to tackle that list and make big changes. And here we see someone who comes in and their first approach is to, nope, let me just sit back and accept and acknowledge the success of this team and that I'm taking over something that works. And what can I do to absorb it first before I try to reform it? Because it may not need as much reform as I want to apply to it. Because it's the ego of a leader that says, I want things to be my way. And it's the humble leader that comes in and says, I respect what you guys have done. Let me learn how to lead you better as opposed to lead you the way that I think you need to be led. So it's another really good observation in the early stages about how he's just picking up and learning early on. So we start with our situation, and Jeff is thrown into the deep end pretty quick. He comes in, he gets this offer, come learn the family business, immediately finds out that the uncle that he's taking over the business from is going to be stepping out a lot faster than expected, right? So we're immediately thrown into a brand new transition situation where our CEO, Jeff, is going to have to learn the business and then take over and run the business pretty quick. And he quickly comes to realize that there's some stuff going on, and Kara, you sort of alluded to this. But let's talk a little bit about sort of the part in the early bit of, you know, disclosure and when it rains, and a little bit more about understanding the situation we've been set up in. So what are some of the early challenges that our protagonist is going to find himself confronting when it comes to his team and his new company?
Well, the company is growing pretty quickly, and the leader's stepping away. So he kind of jumps into it seems like a pressure cooker at first glance when he hears everything that's going on, that they have two new projects going on and probably not enough people to handle them. So
we've never been in that situation, right, Suzanne?
We've always been in that situation.
Never not been in that situation, right? That's how I'm supposed to say that. Yes. Yeah, we've got a family business that's, you know, growing and doesn't quite have the resources. They're about to take on two projects, both of which are as big as anything they've ever done, and they're going to take on two of them at the same time. So pretty daunting set of circumstances. And how does our new leader decide to address some of this?
Well, I think he addresses it much the same way he addresses everything throughout the book, and that's, he takes literally no time to dive into it. He doesn't put off anything. Right at lunch, he shifts his focus and says, okay, well, now it's time to start asking the questions. And not only dives into the fact that they've got these two new projects, but has no problem referencing, you know, cash flow and how the company's looking and are they healthy. Sets up meetings immediately. I just like that. There's no time to waste. You know, this is obviously a larger thing if this were to happen to any one of us. But again, to the point of the book, you can scale this down and realize that it's okay to make fast decisions as long as you're doing the research. There's just get started. Just hit the ground running and get started and start digging in. And he seems very good at, you know, he's good at that throughout the entire book.
Absolutely. And you're exactly right, Joe. He just, you know, he immediately sinks his teeth into it and gets going. And here again, we see Lencioni subtly but assuredly giving us the characterizations we're going to be talking about later in theory in hands-on. This is a perfect example of hungry, right? Jeff comes in as the new CEO. He immediately shows his hunger and says, all right, I'm going to just tackle this stuff head on and not even hesitate and see how deep in we need to get and just go for it. Which again is demonstrating that someone who has the right qualities is someone who's going to be able to be successful long-term in any kind of role such as this. Other thoughts on some of that early hungry that he shows?
I would make the argument, Jeff, that yeah, I mean, he's definitely hungry and he's humble and he's not necessarily smart right away. And so it shows that maybe you don't have to have all three of those traits all the time or necessarily know exactly everything. He comes in, he listens, he talks to his peers, his subordinates, he gets an understanding of what's going on. And so I think initially he shows the humbleness and the hungriness, but he doesn't have the smarts. He's never been in this industry. And so he comes in and tries to gather all the information and get as much knowledge as he can, and then works with his team to come up with these traits of the types of people that he wants in his organization. And that's just a great way to approach it and not rush to make decisions that, you know, he doesn't have enough information about. But yeah, definitely a sense of urgency in the book. You can tell like he's stressed out obviously initially, and but I just think it's interesting and perhaps we'll get into this later about the three traits and maybe, you know, which is more important. I mean, obviously they're all important, but it just shows you don't, you know, smarts and stuff can be trained perhaps. I don't know.
No, I completely agree with you, Andrew. And I do think he makes a point early on to show us that not all traits are firing on all cylinders at all time, and that some can be grown and developed and others, you know, but that there has to be sort of that baseline there. I will say, and I mentioned it earlier, but I'll reiterate it here. This is probably the slowest burn of any of the books. In the other books he's written, the model comes up pretty quick, right? You know, even going back to Five Dysfunctions, Catherine brings up the model on like her first meeting with the team, and she literally lays it out for him on a whiteboard. In this story, I find it interesting that we're almost on the same slow journey of discovery that I think Lencioni himself was on, the realization that it took him 14 years to go from Five Dysfunctions to this book and go, it was under our nose the whole time. And we didn't see it. We couldn't articulate it. We couldn't put language to it. And I think that's such an interesting part because this book does have a very simplistic model. And yet it takes us a while. I think we're halfway through the fable before we finally find out what this model is going to be and how it comes together. And so we've been alluding to it and talking about it, the three things. But let's talk a little bit about how we get there, because that I think that's a key part of the story. So were you surprised how long it took him to get into it? And what did you notice about the journey to figuring out the model that we're going to be using as we talk about identifying and selecting the ideal team player?
I thought it was nice how when they were in the room together, you know, trying to figure out the model of what they were going to do, it was very realistic, you know, just like brainstorming, you know, it's a jackass, you know, it's like a real conversation that you're having. It wasn't, didn't feel like made up, you know, it felt like something that we have on a day-to-day basis. So it's very relatable.
Yeah. So sometimes you wonder if he's just recording your meetings and then turning them into books, right?
Yes.
It's a very Lencioni thing.
Well, it's a collaborative approach too. He got the buy-in from from Bobby and Claire. It wasn't just like, here's what I think and here's the way it's going to be. It was like, let's talk about this. And he valued their opinions and he got everyone to buy in from on the leadership side.
It was nice as well because he asked questions but never really answered them. He would say, like, let the people come up with their own decision. It's right there in front of their face. So don't just give them the answer.
I will say, much to your point, Jeff, you feel like for a large portion of the book that it was like right on the tip of his tongue. And the very first part of the book, and this might be the beer guy in me, but like I thought it was going to go at a faster pace because, and this struck me, and I'd be interested to hear if it struck anybody else. But at the lunch, he said he decided not to finish the rest of his beer. And I was like, oh, wow, things are about to go down. So again, that might just be the beer guy in me, but I'm like, all right, we're about to get into this because you're going to leave the half that beer on the table to dig into this work. And then throughout the book, he kind of, and he alludes to it. He keeps saying, you know, it just seems so simple. It just seems, and you, for a minute, you almost just want to say, spit it out. But I think he needed to go at that pace, because although it's simple, it helped to drill it into my head over and over again. At the end, I almost wanted to scream to him, you're talking about these three things. It's simple. Come on, like, just say it. But I think it was purposefully set up that way. That's all I can assume, because it drilled it into your head. You, by the time he got to the point, you realized exactly what he was getting at and why these three things were so important.
And for the others too, you know, who had been there and had the history of everything, I think for them all to be on the same page that, oh yeah, that's where, oh yeah, we had him and he wasn't the jackass, but his supervisor was the jackass, you know, and it kind of, so maybe he was worth bringing back. So I think that slow build was to help the other team members realize that, you know, they needed to be part of that solution as well.
Well, and also how they got to the three virtues, right? I mean, they didn't just come up with these three words right off the top of their heads. I mean, they had to come up with other describing words, and those weren't making the cut. So just that collaboration, that brainstorming, again, and how they were able to get to these three virtues, I feel play a significant part in the model and how they got there.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think he's very intentional to build this up slowly, and I think it's very intentional to him that they get one, they sort of feel it out, make it right, they get another one, it's not quite right, that's not quite right. Eventually they land on it. It takes longer to get to the final answer in this one than ever. And yet, Joe, I agree with you as well that it seems like it's right there in front of them the whole time. And I think his goal in writing it the way he does it is to show us that these three things, this model for how we identify who are the ideal team players, are so obvious that they're inevitable, and that makes them not obvious at first. We all know it when we see it, and we've all lived in this world of, well, we know it when we see it, and the characters all have that sense of, well, we know it when we see it, but they can't articulate it. And what Lencioni's entire career has been built on is giving language to things that are intuitive but often hard to articulate, and there's power in that language, right? The five dysfunctions, we all understand what a dysfunctional team is. We've been on them, we've seen them, but it's not until he gives us that language of those five steps that we're able to diagnose and address a team's behavior. And similarly now with this, when it comes to, we know what a great team member sort of looks like, and we've always kind of understood there are those who perform better and those who don't, and those that fit us better and those who don't, and we kind of get that when we see it in action, but how do we articulate it such that we could be looking for it ahead of time? It took this team a while, and I think that's because it took him a while, and I think that's because he wants the reader to understand what you're looking for is right in front of you. It's always been there, right? It's the ruby red slippers you were wearing all along. You had it all the time. You just didn't realize it, but once you see it, you can't unsee it, and you can't not realize it. So I think that brings us to the end of our discussion on the fable for today. We've got a lot of ground covered and a lot more to go. This is a book that, you know, because it reads in sort of two halves, it's fun to talk about these things in big ways, but I think we've done a nice job explaining the setup and looking forward to getting into the model part of this as well. But let me take a moment and thank my participants for being here and being a part of it and making this discussion happen. Joe, thanks for being a part of it. Appreciate having you here.
My pleasure. It was awesome.
Nate, thanks for joining us on this one.
Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. Andrew, glad to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Suzanne, as always, appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. And Kara, thanks for joining us on this as well.
Thank you, Jeff. It was fun.
Indeed. Looking forward to even more discussion as we get back into it. This is season two of the Brew University Book Club. The book is The Ideal Team Player by Patrick Lencioni, and we will be back with episode two in just another week. See you then.